Hey there, I'm Matt Walker, the host of the Choir Director Corner podcast. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I'm so excited you are here. Before we dive in, I want to tell you about a one-of-a-kind online resource for choir directors, and it's called the Choir Director Corner Community Membership. This membership was designed to give you the training, the resources, the support, and the community you need to be successful in your teaching. Inside the membership, you'll find online courses, which will help you polish your current skills, as well as learn some new strategies and techniques, a PDF resource library with over 50 PDFs and Google Docs that you can use in your daily teaching and workflows, monthly collaboration calls where you can ask questions, get feedback, and collaborate with choir directors just like you, and access to our recommended repertoire videos and repertoire lists. There's even a private Facebook group, which gives you another place online to collaborate with other choir directors and ask questions. Being a choir director doesn't have to be a DIY endeavor. It's so much better when it's done together. So head on over to choirdirectorcorner.com/membership and join us in the Choir Director Corner community membership. Again, that's choirdirectorcorner.com/membership. All right, on with today's episode. Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Choir Director Corner podcast. My name is Matt Walker. I am your host. Thanks so much for stopping by and joining me for today's episode. And here in episode 74 of the podcast, I'm very excited to share my conversation with composer Katarina Gimmon. Katarina is based out of Vancouver, British Columbia, and I found her music while doing a repertoire search a couple of years ago, and I just fell in love with her work. Her music is so interesting, it's so creative, and she gives singers and conductors the opportunity to explore choral music in some really unique and fascinating ways. Now, whether you are already familiar with her work or not, I think you will really enjoy our conversation, where you get to learn more about Katarina, how her musical background has influenced her work as a composer and her unique composition process, as well as some of the music that she has coming out in the near future. It was a super fun conversation, and I know you are going to love it. So let's dive in. Here is my conversation with composer Katarina Gimmon. Well, I'm very excited to welcome composer Katarina Gimmon to our podcast. Katarina, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, honored to have you on today. So for those people in our audience that are maybe a little unfamiliar with you and your work, why don't you just start and tell us a little bit about your background, your education, musical experiences, all that good stuff.
Sure. Well, right off the bat, I guess I'll just say I'm a Canadian composer living in Vancouver, British Columbia. I write a lot of choral and vocal music, but that's not it. I do write music for electronics, music for orchestras, sort of all over the map. But I'll be focusing, of course, on the choral side of things today. In terms of my background, I've sung for as long as I can remember. I always loved singing. My parents have even told me, you know, stories of when I was a baby, I would wake them up on the baby monitor, just sort of singing whatever, you know, melodies came to my mind, or maybe the latest Disney because I'm a 90s child. So I just loved singing. Any opportunity I could find, I would always be doing that. So as soon as I could convince my parents, I was in music lessons. I did group music lessons for a while, and then eventually I went on to study piano privately and later voice. And then sort of as an offshoot of that, one of my favorite things when I was studying voice was that my singing teacher paired me up, I think at the time, with the person after me, and I would do duets. And I just loved, you know, making music with somebody at the same time. And so my duet partner said, you know what, well, if you like this, you should join this awesome choir that we're part of called the Hamilton Children's Choir in Hamilton, Ontario, just outside of where I grew up. And so I did it on a whim, following my friend's advice. And it turned out to be probably one of the most influential things I've done for my journey, because it turned out that that choir was actually a really good choir. And we toured around the world. We went to, I think while I was with them, we sang in Sweden, Poland, Germany. We learned a lot of fantastic music. Mostly European, I would say, choral music. Our conductor had just moved from Kazakhstan and barely spoke English, but was like very high level kind of stuff. And, you know, as a kid, you never know to be afraid of those kinds of things. So I learned all kinds of weird and wacky choral music at a pretty young age. We staged everything. We toured, and I just fell in love with choral music. After that, I eventually ended up going on to school for my undergraduate degree in music. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with music at the time. So I started actually in a general music degree, but I took composition in my first year as an elective, and I liked it so much that I ended up switching into composition after that point. And then in my second year, I did a similar thing. I took an improvisation elective. And then at the end of my second year, I switched into composition and improvisation. So by the end of my third year, I'd changed programs three times, but eventually settled on this weird, unique kind of degree of studying both composition and improvisation with voice as my instrument, which is a little unique. But I had so much fun that at the end of that, I ended up going on to do my master's degree, where I'm living currently in Vancouver, British Columbia, at the University of British Columbia. And at that point, some interesting things happened. I joined the laptop orchestra, which was sort of the first foray for me into the world of, you know, electronic music and interactive electronic music, which has influenced some of the way that I write for choral music, actually, interestingly enough. And at that point, I also started to sort of immerse myself into the city and got my first choral commissions, and my first commissions of anything, I should say. And at that point, I think I graduated in 2017, so not too long ago in the horizon. And I worked for 2 years part-time admin for an orchestra just outside of town while I built up my my composing work. And then in 2019, you know, unknowing that there was about to be a pandemic, I went full-time freelance, which is I was very lucky to be able to do that, that I had got enough stuff on the go. And since then, I've just been composing lots, especially since the pandemic. I like to joke, I think you said you're a voice major, so you might remember from music history class learning about, you know, Schumann's Year of Song after he married Clara, where he wrote all the music. I feel like my pandemic time has been like my 2 years of song, because I wrote so much music that's all just starting to get out into the world. But that's sort of a little bit about my story and where I'm at now.
Wonderful. So let's talk about the pandemic time a little bit. So you mentioned that you kind of had some things that you were already working on. Did you sort of have to shift your focus a little bit, since a lot of choirs were maybe not meeting regularly at that time? Did you maybe do some composing, like you mentioned, for electronics or some other things? Or were you able to, like you said, you just kind of had enough things already planned where you didn't have to change a whole lot?
A little bit of both, I'd say. I had a couple things that sort of didn't happen or got delayed. And at the same time, because I do work with electronics as well, I ended up with a lot more interest in the music that I do with electronics, for the obvious reason of, you know, that it could be presented a lot more easily than getting together a choir that can't sing in the same room. So those two things sort of happened coincidentally. But one exciting thing that happened in the choir world, which maybe I'll expand about a little bit later, is a lot more interest in collaborative commissioning, which is something I've always been very interested in. Even before the pandemic, I would go in and work with groups, you know, varying degrees of collaboration of choristers in the group, maybe having them help with the lyric writing, maybe having them suggest themes for the piece, maybe having them help with the melodic ideas. So any degree of things. But during the pandemic, the fact that you could sort of involve quiet choristers in the process of that over Zoom, I found super, super exciting. So I started doing a little bit more of that on my own. And I even ended up founding an interesting project called the Sonic Time Lapse Project, which is a Canadian collaborative commissioning project. So it's a consortium project, essentially, but it was created during pandemic times so that choirs could pool resources to commission music, but not only were they commissioners, they were also able to find a way for their choristers to be involved by submitting materials that the composers, there was 10 composers selected for this, would use as inspiration for their pieces. And this happened for about a year during the pandemic, and things were submitted throughout the year, and each composer would write a piece, you know, every month. So hence where the name came from. It became like a little bit of a time lapse of the emotional landscape of the choral music world during the pandemic. So that was pretty cool. The piece I created, if anyone's interested in checking it out, is called A Path to Hope, but it was all inspired by, you know, of choristers submitting stuff, of conductors submitting things and inputting their ideas and influencing what composers could make. So it was a really cool process.
Well, you know, the pandemic wasn't all bad, right? Like I tried to find silver linings, and, you know, that's something that came, you know, that was really good that came of that time too. So.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, 100%. I feel like people are a lot more, they're a lot more likely to reach out to you and have things like Zoom rehearsals or workshops, or things like that, which before even, you know, even for example, if I had a commission with someone, maybe I would get them on the phone to talk about it. But now people are a lot more like, yes, let's do that. Yes, let's meet over Zoom to, you know, chat with my choristers. It's a lot easier. There's not as much barrier because we've just gotten so used to it. And I don't know, had this not happened, would I have been able to connect with so many, you know, so many performers, so many singers, so many conductors in such a meaningful way. So I think in that sense, it's been very remarkable.
Yeah, that's pretty much all we did for almost 2 years was Zoom,
yeah. So. Thank God, though. I mean, better than nothing, right?
I know. Like sometimes I sit and say, you know, what in the world did we do before Zoom? It's like Google. Like, what in the world did we do before Google? So yeah,
I know.
It's wonderful.
Remember Skype?
I think we actually still have Skype on one of our devices here at Hope. So,
oh, really? Yeah, I think that's what we did. I was thinking about it the other day. I was like, oh, yeah, Skype. That doesn't happen anymore.
we tried using Skype, I think, twice, and we had so many issues with it that we quickly moved on to something else. Yeah. So thank goodness for Zoom. So. So you talked a little bit about your musical background and how you're involved in lots of different areas and types of music. Was your undergrad sort of the first time that you really considered composing? You talked about how you kind of switched majors a couple of times, which is fairly common for many of us. But was that the first time you had ever thought about that? Or do you remember earlier on in your musical experiences, you know, contemplating maybe one day being a composer as a profession?
I'll say, I don't think I seriously thought about it definitely until that moment, but I think the seed was planted because I always liked writing in one way or another. I think I just didn't have a name for it. I always wrote songs, you know, when I was little with, you know, lyrics about, you know, whatever 4-year-old me was interested in, cheese or whatever. And then, you know, into my middle school and high school days, I sort of lived a lot more in the singer-songwriter realm. And I think part of that was just, I grew up in a time period where, you know, there was a lot of amazing, strong women role models. And so I think I just saw a lot more representation and felt, you know, like I belonged a lot more in that world. And I hadn't in the same way in the world of composition. But seeds began to be planted, you know, a little later. The voice teacher I studied with, she wrote music as well. So seeing her, I think she was probably the first composer that I met, that was a woman and, you know, that was alive and that you could make that kind of connection. And then later on the choir that I sang with, I think the year before I went to university, we worked with, Sarah Cortell. We were the first, upper voices group to sing her Snow Angel piece. She's very well known now, but I mean, meeting her, I think also, you know, at the time, I didn't quite have the thought, oh, hey, maybe I could be a composer. But I think looking back, you know, when you sort of trace the thread, seeing that eventually sort of led me to that point that, you know, when I got into university and the opportunity presented itself, I said to myself, okay, hey, I can think of other people that have done this. I've seen that. And I think it encouraged me to have role models like that, to have people that I could look up to consider the field for myself.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way of talking about it, how seeds were being planted. It's funny how that works. Like sometimes these seeds are being planted when we don't even know it at
the
time.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the wonderful thing about life. And I mean, always tracing back these things later. It's never just one thing that happened. You remember when it does happen, but it's usually a series of little things leading up to it. So Yeah.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, when I talk to composers, one of the big questions I'm always curious about is talking about the compositional process. And I know that that can change from piece to piece, you know, depending on the content and the text and all of that. But talk a little bit about, do you have sort of a standard compositional process that you kind of base everything off of and that you might then change or tweak depending on the piece of music that you're working on?
I do. And this is one of my favorite things to talk about. So thank you.
Hey, I love it.
So I've learned that the compositional process I have is a little weird for composers. A lot of composers will actually move to staff papers. One of the first things they might mention. But I'm quite a visually oriented person. And I think I mentioned I come from a background as a songwriter. So for me, I tend to move a lot more to actually, you know, physicality, to singing and to larger brushstrokes, you know, brainstorming early in my process. And I'll explain what that means. So my process looks a little something like this. I will get a blank sheet of paper. And if I have a text that I'm working with, I'll put it side by side to that and I'll read through the text and I'll pick out keywords or emotions that come to it. And I'll write that on my piece of paper. Love, time, bird, whatever it is, key things. I will sort of collect those onto this piece of paper. And at that point, you know, you'll also get the rhythm of the text and syllabic emphasis and things like that. But once I'm done sort of collecting those important moments, then what I'll do is I'll flip over that piece of printer paper and I'll organize them on a timeline. So landscape piece of paper, what is the climax of the piece? Maybe when we're at, you know, love lost or something like that, if that's a word that I had on there, or maybe at the beginning I wrote the word vulnerable or silence. I'll put those in different spots and sort of mark what exactly the shape of the piece is going to be. And I'll draw a little image often as well. If people are interested, you can check this out. I post some of these things on my Instagram if you want to see. And I create what's called a graphic score, which is essentially a visual representation of what I want the piece to sound like. Again, this is very broad stroke. So it could be something as simple as just having, you know, a large triangle shape just going up right to the end. Maybe the climax is my last chord. Or maybe I have it going up to 3/4 of the way through and then it drops down and we have something quiet. The possibilities are endless, but I'll write those things and I'll sort of shape them around the emotional context or certain words in the piece. Then what I'll do is I will open my DAW. So I think you mentioned you use GarageBand. I use, yep, GarageBand or Ableton now. And I will look at those different sections of the piece and say, okay, I wrote vulnerable at the beginning. I have this sort of doodle that I made of something that's swirling. What could that sound like? And I will improvise and explore music ideas and basically just record them into my DAW. And I'll continue that process going through that entire graphic score, exploring what different musical ideas could be to convey those things that I've written down in my plan until I have a piece. And then like an architect, I keep going through, I sculpt it, I re-record, I lengthen, I shorten until it sounds like what I want. And then when the piece is basically almost entirely done and exists in audio form, I'll actually go and write it down after that, which is a little different than I think than most, but a lot of that I think comes from the fact that, you know, I lived in the world as a songwriter for a long time where that's what you do. You actually really don't write anything down until it's done. and I found I really like doing that because it tends to keep me creative. I don't feel like I get bogged down too early in the weeds or in notes. So it's something I've noticed that can happen with young composers. And this has happened to me in the past, which is part of the reason I developed this process, is that if you move to notation too soon, and especially notation software, you'll compose what you know how to compose rather than what you actually want. Like if you don't know how to change the time signature, something as simple as that, you'll say, I'm just going to leave it in 4/4 because that's what I know how to do rather than what I actually want to do. But when you're just using your voice, when you're just recording it, I don't even think about that. I just say, this is what I want. I put it down and then later I can worry about it. And I never have that, you know, even if it's subconsciously happening, I never stifle my creativity in that way. So I always like to use that process for that reason.
Yeah, that seems not only is it incredibly creative, but I am someone where, you know, I hate to have to go back and redo things. And so to me, approaching it from a pencil and paper, I mean, I would probably go through 5 erasers before I even had one page. Where, you know, we have the technology at our disposal now where you can go through and, like you said, just be very creative from the audio perspective. And then once you feel like you've got everything to where you want it, or like you said, to close to where you want it, because there's always that sculpting that goes on. But then that's the point where you can take it to actual notation. Yeah, that's
exactly
fantastic.
Yeah. And this process, I mean, even the early, you know, the brainstorming part is something that you can use for anything. You know, I mean, you're trying to write an essay or whatever it is, you know, brainstorm those initial ideas and then go deeper down. It can work for any, you know, creative art form or anything you're doing. You know, and if any groups are interested, I do actually use this, or I have been using it, I should say, over the pandemic as a Zoom session for groups that are interested in, you know, introducing their choristers to learning how to graphic score or doing early creativity exercises. So
wonderful. And before I forget, where can people find you on Instagram? You mentioned your Instagram.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So people can find me on Instagram at Kat Gimon, KatGimon. And if you're interested, I just posted a reel of my piece Fire, which is one of my most popular pieces, of me going through this process just quickly and taking a little screenshot of, you know, that early brainstorm, what it looked like for Fire, what did my graphic score look like for it, what did my, you know, Ableton session look like for that. And so it's, you can see in 30 seconds what that process looks like, and it's pretty cool to see it go from that to the final product. So check it out, Kat Gimon.
And while we're talking about social media and your piece Fire, I heard a little something, and I'm not on TikTok regularly, but I heard something about your piece kind of making the rounds on TikTok. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the Texas All-State Treble Choir performed, I think, back in February, my piece Fire, and they did an absolutely fantastic performance. And it finally got posted, and I guess TikTok was the first place it emerged, on Monday or Tuesday. And I didn't even know until I started getting all of these messages from my friends, because I'm not on TikTok either, saying, oh, your piece is going TikTok viral. And I watched the video, and I mean, I teared up because it is such a fantastic, powerful performance that these amazing women did. So I encourage you to look it up if you want to take a listen. TMEA 2022 Fire, Katarina Gimon. Just give it a Google. It's on YouTube, and it seems to be in all the places now. But I think last time I looked, the original video had like over 2 million views. And this is like a week.
Oh my goodness.
Which is so wild. This is, you know, for
a
piece.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, for a piece that I wrote during my undergraduate degree. I only wrote that when it was in my second year. So it's sort of wild to see a piece that, you know, was part of my early creative journey and sort of figuring out that process that I just talked to you about. Years later, you know, keep on giving, taking on a new life. And I think that's really exciting. And that's one of the wonderful things, you know, about the art form that we have, that it's this living, breathing, exciting thing. So, yeah.
Oh, that's very exciting. Yeah. I'll include a link to that. I'll look it up and I'll include that so that people can easily find that as well. Because yes, I'm sure they're going to want to check that out. So cool. Now, getting back to compositional process a little bit, and you talked about you just mentioned your use of graphic scores and graphic notation. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that because, you know, I've been on your website, which is beautiful, by the way, and getting on there and looking at some of the scores, and also on Graphite Publishing, you know, there's some scores on there as well. And if people kind of, you know, aren't familiar with you and your work, and then they step into one of these scores, I think you mentioned A Path to Hope. The first movement of A Path to Hope, well, it kind of fits this bill. It's just like, oh my goodness, what am I looking at? Like, it's so cool. But, it, you know, if we don't know exactly what's going on, I'm sure it's not. But, it, you know, on first glance, might be a little bit daunting. So first of all, talk about what is a graphic score, graphic notation, and how you like to use that, depending on the piece and the subject matter, to sort of bring that music to life.
Yeah. So I first got introduced to graphic scores in my improvisation days in my undergraduate degree. When I mentioned that I switched into that, I took a class and I was the only vocalist in a class of, you know, saxophone, violin, whatever it was. And it seems to be a lot more common in the world of instrumental music to explore music that incorporates graphic elements or scores that are entirely graphic scores. And when I say that, I should just briefly put a little addendum. A graphic score is just a visual representation of music. And it could be as simple as, you know, a line just ascending. You could interpret that as, you know, your pitch ascending or your volume going up. It could also be something a little bit more abstract that looks a little bit more like a painting or a combination of various elements. But the exciting thing about graphic scoring is that it can help convey things that we don't really have the means to do in Western music notation. Our system of notation, you know, grew out of, you know, church music. It is meant to show notes. It is meant to show notes in a certain scale. There's certain things that it's just not built to show in a nice way. And I think in addition to that, there's also certain aspects like emotion and character and other things that I think can be enhanced with visual elements being added to a piece of music. And so that's sort of the way that I look at incorporating graphic elements into my music, is with that approach. If there's something, for example, you said in Voiceless, that, you know, the entire piece, for people who don't know it, is based on the Morse code spelling of the word voiceless. And there really isn't a system to depict body percussion. So I had to create a little bit of a system to show where your hands go, what the rhythm is and whatnot, and to make it easier or as easy as possible to do that. So that's one. The other piece, Fire, that I talked about 3/4 of the way through the piece, I ask singers to include some shouts and some calling. Again, in Western music notation, we don't really have a note or a figure that exists to depict something like that. So what I did is I drew a flame to give sort of the energy that I'm looking for in addition to the description. Because of course, you know, you can always just write the words, do calls, do shouts, and that technically does the job, but something about adding visuals to it, I feel like gives a lot better idea of where the composer is coming from. And help get choristers, I think, more quickly into the mindset of, oh, this is the energy, this is the spirit that they're looking for. Which I think is a pretty exciting thing. And it also, I think, helps to engage / flex the creativity muscles of choristers, which is the last reason I'll say I include it in my music, which I think is a pretty exciting thing. I will say, you know, as a biased person, I always enjoyed singing music in choir growing up that had space for me to do things like that. And often it was music that incorporated graphic elements. So that's something I always try and do for my own stuff as well.
Yeah, and just talking about how people learn in different ways, I can only imagine that when choirs get a piece of music like that, the visual learners are like, probably like hands up in the air, like, yes, like this is how I learned. I get it. This is awesome. So in your workings with choirs, have you ever encountered singers or choirs that maybe have a little bit of difficulty as far as like interpreting then that graphic score, that graphic notation?
There's different levels of fear when they first see the score. I mean, some people are really excited. Some people just have no idea how to approach it, and that's okay. It's something unusual, but I think the great thing about it is that, you know, it ensues a conversation about, you know, what music is, what notation, the fact that there's different notation systems and things like that. But certain pieces, again, I'll go back to Fire, also by doing things like that, I think also encourage other ways of learning. If anyone's done that piece or goes and takes a look at the score, it's created in a series of loops and it's written really nicely in that way. So you can only see when a part is changing. And if it's a part that's staying the same, it actually just continues with this squiggly line, essentially. So as a conductor and as a chorister, once you learn the piece and you learn the couple ideas that your part needs to know, you can very clearly see, oh, here's something's changing, there's something changing, there's something changing. And you got a lot better sense, I find, of the overall scope of a piece. And it actually works really well, I find, for choristers for listening. It's a sneaky listening exercise. when you do things like that.
Absolutely.
As well. So I'm sneakily putting listening exercises in my music by doing that.
Well, and I love how you put that, because I think for some singers, there is maybe, I don't know if fear is the right word, but you know, a lot of singers, they want to know exactly what they're supposed to do. Like they want, mm-hmm. you know, it to be very clear cut. This is the intent. I want notes on the page. And, mm-hmm. you know, I don't want to have to really, you know, worry about, you know, making decisions. I'm going to let the conductor do that, and I'm just going to sit here and sing. Where a lot of your music, you know, I really just see it as an opportunity to engage singers in very mm-hmm. different ways. You know, it might be a little cliche, but, you know, sort of outside of the box is how I would term it. And in getting to engage singers in those types of ways, it's such a cool and creative opportunity that, you know, we don't always see in choral music.
Yeah. And I think, you know, especially nowadays, it's part of the reason I've always been drawn to it in my music. And I think other people connect to it is by doing things like that. You know, even if, you know, some singers are really into it, but some are a little bit more tentative, it's something for growth, but it's also something that helps to living in the moment. Musically, which I think is something we all strive for when we're making music, is to be in that space, you know, where you feel just that flow of everything and you feel so connected in the moment when you're making that music. And I find when you leave a little bit more space, even if it's just, you know, a couple bars or a moment where you say, you all say this line, but at a different time, you end up with a lot more singer engagement naturally, because they have to be engaged because they are making that decision. And I think having that autonomy also helps them feel, what's the word? Like they have a bit more say and a bit more contribution to the final result of the piece as well. Just by having that autonomy. And I think that's really powerful for singer engagement. And something I always do my best to try and harness by leaving space for that, in my music, because I mean, in the end, as a composer, you're just a vehicle for performers to take on this music and to learn it. They are still part of that process. If I just wrote a piece of music and left it on my desk, you know, no one's going to hear it. You're part of that life. And I think all I'm doing is just sort of moving over that line of saying, you know, I'm going to leave even a little bit more for you to say. So you are, in a way, you know, a co-composer of this piece, and you are making that performance that you're doing even more unique, even more you, even more representative of, you know, your life and your world. And I think that's powerful, and that's meaningful music making. And that's what I want to do. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love that. So I love that a lot of the things that you've been talking about lend itself really well to another element that I've noticed in some of your compositions, which I guess I would call it maybe improvisation, or you know, a sense of spontaneity. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how that has become part of your compositional process.
Yeah, so from my days back in my undergraduate degree, where I studied improvisation, free improvisation, I should say, not classical or not jazz improvisation, essentially live composing, I will say, in a way, because you have to just sort of live in the moment and create music. Anything from, you know, you're placed with, you know, a saxophone and a flute, and they say, make a minute of music, to you're giving a little bit more parameters. You know, it needs to be 2 minutes, and it starts slow with short notes, and it ends with quick notes, and they're long or something like that. But it completely varies. But I like to include improvisation because there's something about the way it engages choristers to just be in the moment, to listen, to flex their musicianship muscles without even thinking about it, because they're having fun. You have to be there in order to improvise, because you need to be paying attention in case, you know, you need to make an interest, you need to be listening so that you can get an overall sense of everything that's happening and help contribute. So it's a lot of sneaky ear training and listening exercises when you can do things like that. And maybe I'll mention, I'm actually working on a project right now a set of graphic score studies, very short graphic score studies for choir. They're probably going to be about a page or two each, intended for choirs that are interested in exploring improvisation and graphic scores, but have never done it before. To give a place to start, just something very simple, a very flexible exercise that you can just use in a warm-up, or if you want to use it in a, you know, in a concert, you can do that, or even, you know, as a transitional piece. Sometimes choirs like to do that. You can do something like that, but it gives a place to start, essentially a formula for you to use with your choir and to get them thinking creatively, get them listening, get them engaged, and get them knowing a little bit more about other ways of, you know, notating music and other forms of art. I think it's super undervalued. I think in our educational systems right now, just the power of what improvisation can do, and getting in tune with that with your choristers as well.
Yeah. And that element of improvisation, you know, it can be a little scary for singers, but like you said, if they have that formula, they have that blueprint, almost like here are some basic instructions, and also approaching it from, you know, a perspective of growth mindset, it's like, there are no wrong answers. It's totally fine. Like, you can just go and be creative, and you don't have to worry about making mistakes and adding that into the process as well, which can then spill over into other parts of what we do as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, a huge part of the reason, you know, I entered in improvisation in school was for that exact reason. It's, I feel like you always have to be, you know, slightly out of your comfort zone to grow. And I'm so glad I switched into it, because not only did it help me as a composer, but as a performer and overall as a musician, because it teaches you so many skills. And I think, like the first thing you said, if the task is clear, I think some conductors are worried that, you know, if my choristers won't know what to do. If the task is clear, if you provide them with the formula, I'm sure, you know, your students are great at breaking the rules and pushing the bounds, you know, of what they are. So if you give them a very clear task, it's actually really engaging and really fun for them to figure out, okay, what can I do within this? You know, how can I make it work within these constraints that have been giving me? And more often than not, that's actually what sparks, I think, the most creative thinking and the most creative ideas. I think Stravinsky has a quote that something along the lines of, the more I constrict my ideas and the more I limit myself, the more creative I actually am. And I think that's completely, completely true in this sense. As long as you have a good formula for improvising, for doing these types of exercises, your singers will actually just, you know, fly free within that, and not only discover, you know, these musicianship skills, but also I think build confidence, build autonomy, especially for young singers. And I think that's extremely important. I remember my first year of studying improvisation and having those moments where, this happens more as a singer, I'm sure, I meant to sing a different note. It didn't happen. But those moments, you know, you run with it, and listening back, I'm like, that moment where I messed up and then I did it twice to make it seem like I meant like it are actually the most interesting and cool things that happened in the piece. And sort of just learning to run with it and have that skill is actually so useful and probably one of the best things I've ever learned. And so I constantly try and do that now, just to, you know, let it go, see what happens, because there are no mistakes. Like you said, there's no wrong answers, and that's part of the fun of it.
You talk about studying improvisation in school. So just tell me a little bit about that, because here in the States, we don't necessarily, for music educators or even, you know, unless you're in jazz, there's really not any sort of improvisation going on. So was that what you were doing? Or is there a different improvisation class?
It was actually classical improvisation. So it was not jazz. There was no jazz at the school I was studying at. It was essentially a room full of, you know, mismatched instruments. I think I mentioned I was the only singer. And we'd come in and we would do things like read graphic scores. There's a famous piece called In C by Terry Riley. We would do things like that are more aleatoric. We would come in and, you know, every week, each of us had to come up with an idea. Like I might say, we're going to do a piece and we're all going to be spread out. And when somebody makes a sound, we all have to like go out like a ripple and make something. So it could be like the simplest idea. It could be more complex, but then within that you have to create music. So it was more like live composing, I guess I will say.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit along that spectrum, essentially. But yeah, it wasn't jazz, because jazz improvisation is its whole other thing.
Ball
yeah,
of you wax.
Sort of
yeah.
learn through that medium. So this was more in the world of free improvisation. I don't know if I'd even call it classical. Technically, we're all classical musicians, but it was more just free improvisation and sort of along the lines of just composing in the moment.
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, because that's not something that you typically see in music programs. I wish it was. Yeah,
it's not common even in Canada. I think that might be one of the few schools in Canada that offers something like that. So I was very lucky that I happened to go to a school that offered that. But again, one of the most influential things, in life, it's all about growth and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone. And when I did that, it helped me so much as a composer, as a singer, to just say, if I make a mistake, I'm really good to just correct, and keep going, because I've had to be in a place where I'm constantly there, because when you're improvising, you literally have to be there the entire time. Because if you drift away, you could miss something, you can't react. You have to be in the moment in order to make good music when you're doing that. So it's a really extremely useful skill that I wish was taught more. And I think absolutely. Something that has for some reason been lost, because if you think back to Bach and Beethoven and, early music, even improvisation was, performers did that. Composers did that. You were trained in improvisation, and I don't know where we lost that along the way, but we should do more of it.
Well, not only is it so creative, thinking from a teacher perspective, talking about having everybody engaged all at once, people, complain all the time about classroom management. Like, well, do something like that where people don't even have time to misbehave, because they're constantly going to be engaged with what's going on in rehearsal.
Exactly. And that's part of the reason. I sneak it into my music for that reason, but also that, I'm taking on these other projects.
Yeah. And that transitions us very well into talking about some of these projects that you've got going on. You talked a little bit about the graphic score studies that you're working on. Give us maybe a little bit of a preview of some of the other things that you're working on currently.
Yeah. Well, I think I mentioned earlier, it was my year/2 years of song during the pandemic. So I actually have a whole lot of choral music coming out. I think I had this spring/summer a total of like 11 premieres. So oh, wow. If you're interested in hearing some more of my music and getting some new stuff, I built up a lot over the pandemic that is going to be coming out in the next year. So I encourage you to, follow me on social, check out my website, check out my newsletter, but I'll mention, I guess one that I'm really excited about, a piece that I'm actually just putting the finishing touches on right now, is a set of 5 choral works for upper voices for Myriad Ensemble, who is actually an upper voice ensemble that I'm in residence for. And they are sung from the perspective of 5 landscapes going from east to west across Canada that are threatened by the climate crisis. Which I've always been very passionate about the environment in my music. I've always been passionate about bringing to life the words of women. This is a text by a living woman poet, a Canadian poet, a good friend of mine, Lauren Pete, who I actually grew up in singing with choir with, funny enough. But this piece is sort of in the realm of my piece, Elements, which Fire is from, where it's a lot more textural, explorative, sort of has those moments for a lot of these things that we've been talking about, creativity and whatnot. And it's been such a joy to compose, but also such a powerful piece in that, what does a mountain range sound like, if it could sing, something that's being threatened by the climate right now? What does a glacier that is melting sound like? How can we bring those things to life in music? And I've always been such a huge fan of picking strange things like that to bring to life in music, that when we don't have the words, I think sometimes music is what we need. And that piece, I feel like, is that's exactly what it's become. And I'm so excited for people to hear it. That one's going to premiere as part of Myriad's next season, date TBA. But as soon as I know, you will know. It's going to be pretty cool. I'm going to make some voicings of it for SATB and lower voices and some other options as soon as it's done as well. But I think that one's going to be a really powerful, unique piece. So, yeah.
Oh, so exciting. So will that, when it comes out, where's the first place that sort of gets publicized. Is that your website?
Probably my website. Yeah, my website, or if you follow me on social media or my email newsletter, either of those, whatever, you know, your preferred format of finding things out, give me a follow there. But as soon as it's out, I will be sharing, you know, the details about the concert, the details about the recording, and the details about its publication on there.
Terrific. Well, we'll make sure at the very end of our conversation, we'll get all those details. So
great.
We'll make sure people can find you. So in addition to all of this wonderful music, you mentioned earlier on in our conversation, how you like to work from this perspective of collaborative creation, and also a little bit about this project, the Sonic Time Lapse project. So talk to us a little bit about this collaborative creation process and what that looks like, and then maybe give us a few more details about this wonderful Sonic Time Lapse project.
Sure. Well, I'll give a couple examples, first of all, of, you know, what a collaborative commissioning project could look like. So for example, before the pandemic, I worked with a children's choir who wanted to involve their singers in the creation process in some way. And so I suggested that it would be good to involve them in the lyric writing. And so I ended up coming for their fall retreat and coming in for a couple of hours. And I had picked a theme. It was a Disney concert. So it ended up being a piece about dragons, which, let me tell you, singers that age, they were all about writing about dragons. And so we talked a little bit about what lyric writing is. And I gave them a format, essentially, like, here's your rhyming scheme. Here's how long we want each phrase to be, so that it was quite unified. And I put them together in pairs. And they came back with usually a stanza or two each, honestly, more material than I could take. But they were so creative. Oh my gosh, some of the lines I got about them, you know, just like, eating frogs and just these things these dragons were doing were hilarious. It was wonderful. And I got to go home and I got to assemble these into a story that we had sort of talked about. And then I went on and set that. So that's one example where they were involved in the lyric writing process. Another example, over the pandemic, I worked with a group. This was like a high school level choir, so a little bit older. And I had a conversation with them right off the bat, and I met with them and I said, you know, what are your favorite pieces to sing? Why can you name those musical things? And so we actually got to dive a little bit more deeply into having them think a little bit more like a composer. What is my favorite piece? What is it doing musically that makes me like that? So they wanted body percussion. They wanted a fast piece. I started asking them questions like, what music do you think the world needs right now? And at the time they thought, you know, I think the world needs a song of hope. And they had gone a little bit more specific. So things like that. And we had a conversation about an hour going through the process of things like that. Then the next week, based on that material and thinking of where I could go with the music, I brought a series of prompts. So again, this is an older group, so they had a little bit more freedom. I brought a series of prompts because the piece was on the idea of what is hope. I asked them, what does hope sound like? What does hope feel like? And a series of things like that, where I could get them thinking creatively and to fill in the ends of sentences. And eventually I went away with the fruits from that session as well. And I turned that into lyrics for a piece for them. Also incorporating the ideas they had given me earlier about, you know, what they wanted the piece to sound like. They wanted body percussion, they wanted fast, these kinds of things. So that's example number two. The farthest along the line would be, you know, I come in and I have a couple of days to work with the group. We might have the availability to do involvement in both the melodic material and the lyrics. That would be sort of the furthest along the way. Those two other ones were sort of a little bit in the middle, but it could also just be as simple, you know, as going in and having that first conversation I mentioned that I had with that high school choir. You could always, you know, if I'm working with the group, I always offer, if you'd like, I can pop in for 15 minutes over Zoom, you know, or if I'm in the area, I can pop in person and let's connect face to face. Because I think having that face to face time with the composer and saying, oh, you know, we got to have this conversation before the piece even started, and we could actually have the chance to influence that idea. Maybe some chorister had said, I really want a piece about this, or this is really meaningful to me. And then to see, you know, 6 months down the line, the piece come out and say, wow, you know, I was involved in this process. It's this exciting living art form. Also just to see that composers are alive. You'd be surprised how many young singers just don't even realize that there's composers that are, you know, not too far off in age from them, that are alive, that are exciting people. They're not just, you know, Beethoven and Bach, or Mozart or whoever. So to have that kind of connection, I think is really exciting, and engaging, but also has effects of, I think I talked a little bit earlier in the podcast about, you know, me having the seeds planted when I saw Sarah Cortell working with my choir. You never know the ripple effects of doing things like that. Even if it's just 15 minutes or a Q&A or somebody coming into a rehearsal, seeing people do things like that might open up the door for one of your choristers who might not have ever considered, you know, composing or doing something creative or living and working in the field. So, I think it's just great to bring in those kinds of opportunities for that way. But anyways, that's just a couple of ways of things that that could look like. For anybody who's interested, you can pop over to my website and sort of get a little bit more idea of what that can look like. I offer, yeah, workshops, plus, of course, yeah, the commissioning kinds of things. And then I think your other question was about Sonic Time Lapse Project, which I talked, I talked a little bit about at the very beginning. I think I'm going to add to that. So I'll briefly say, in case anybody's tuning in later in the podcast, that essentially this project was a collaborative commissioning project. So along the lines of a lot of things I spoke about already, that involved 10 composers and a number of choirs from across Canada and the United States that took part sort of to collaboratively compose these works. But their choristers and their conductors and people in their communities were also involved in contributing materials that became inspiration for these pieces. So it was very loose in terms of guidelines, how the composers would interpret it. But I'll tell you a little bit what the creative process looked like. And of course, you can tell I was involved as a creator of this project because it looks a lot like my creative process. But essentially, the instructions we gave people if they wanted to contribute something to potentially be inspiration for a piece was to get a blank piece of printer paper and then to write on the center of it an emotion that they were feeling at the time. Could be, you know, exhausted, could be overwhelmed, could be thankful. And then to fill in the rest of that piece of paper in any way they wanted. And so we got all sorts of things. Some people collaged, some people wrote down, you know, lyrics, some people wrote down poems, some people journaled, some people drew, all sorts of things. Then they flipped over the page and they wrote a contrasting emotion and they repeated the exercise. And at the very end of this, they took a picture or they scanned it. And these all ended up in a Google Drive that the composers could pull from when they were creating the pieces. And so every composer did something different. Some would take, you know, little fragments from there, which I did at times in my piece, and they might use it as lyrics. Some might take it as general inspiration. It was sort of up to composers how they would do that. But it was very powerful, the music that ended up coming out of it that resulted from this connection, even though, you know, you hadn't met or I hadn't met, you know, as one of the composers who'd done the project, the hundreds of people that had submitted to this, I was able to go through these things and get a sense of what they're feeling and what kind of music could come out of that. And I thought that was a really unique process and created some really, really, really powerful music. Some of the pieces, you know, like mine is now up with Graphites. Tracy Wong is another composer who wrote a piece as part of it. Hers is up on Graphites. Marie-Claire Sandon's is on Hal Leonard. So all these pieces now are just coming out into the world, but all very, very powerful music based on, you know, beginning with these little seeds of ideas in the choral music community. So very exciting stuff.
Well, Katarina, I think that wraps up our time together. I know that you and your work, they're, as you mentioned, you know, having ripples. And I can just tell that you are going to continue to make ripples with countless numbers of singers and choir directors in the future. You and your work, you're so that's just so amazing. So tell us about the website and any social media outlets where we can find you and your work.
Okay, so the best place to find out all about me and my work is my website, www.katarinagimmon.com, and that's Katarina with a K, and make sure there's an E in there, Kate, Rena, not Katrina, and Gimmon spelt like Simon. And when you go there, I have a nice works page where I have all my choral music highlighted on there. I try and keep it as up to date as I can. I'm usually pretty good within a month or so of music coming out, it'll be on there. If you want to be super in the know, if you scroll down to the bottom of my website, I have links for all my social pages, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all of that. I also have an email newsletter that I usually put out, you know, twice or so a year. Don't worry, it's not too much. That gives highlights of any new releases I have and publications. So that's a great way to stay in touch if you want something a little bit less all the time as social media is. So I encourage you to give those a sign up and hopefully look forward to connecting with all the listeners here at some point.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for that. I've just had a blast talking with you today. So thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to share a bit of yourself and your work with our listeners.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Katarina. She is so much fun and is writing such incredible music. I hope that you will check out her work. I'll be sure to post a link in the show notes where you can find out more about her and her work online. And my friends, that is it for today's episode. If you've been enjoying the podcast, if you would do me a favor and go to wherever you listen to your podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and review. That will help other choir directors to find the podcast and help me in my goal of serving as many choir directors as possible. Another way that I serve choir directors is through the Choir Director Corner community membership, which you can find over at choirdirectorcorner.com/membership. You now have the option of signing up on an annual plan, which gives you 12 months for the price of 10. So to find out more, that link again is choirdirectorcorner.com/membership. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, keep being awesome. Are you looking for resources that will save you time and frustration? Want to dive deeper into topics related to your teaching? Then check out the Choir Director Corner community membership over at choirdirectorcorner.com/membership.